John Glazer. My guest today is Stephen Wertheim, Senior Fellow in the American Statecraft Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He's also a visiting fellow at Yale Law and author of Tomorrow the World, The Birth of U.S. Global Supremacy. Stephen, welcome to the show.
I'm delighted to be with you. Thanks.
So we're several weeks out from the withdrawal in Afghanistan, and we've just passed the 20th anniversary of 9/11. On the one hand, there's a sense in the air that we're turning a corner, that we're at an inflection point where post-9/11 policies are either coming to an end or being seriously reevaluated. And then on the other hand, below the surface of the kind of politics that most Americans consume, certainly seems to me like there's a lot that hasn't changed. Talk a little bit about the withdrawal, all the politics that surrounded that, how you think that went, and assess where American foreign policy is at as we pass the 20-year mark since 9/11.
I think the withdrawal from Afghanistan was predictably tragic in its immediate consequences. The Taliban taking over the country does not bode good things for the people of Afghanistan. Of course, neither did the war. Of course, there was a lot of chaos that attended the evacuations, although I think in the end, the United States was able to evacuate most Americans and many thousands of vulnerable Afghans, and that's quite a good thing. But I think there was no good way to lose a war to the Taliban. There was no plausible scenario in which somehow there was going to be a magnanimous, gentle Taliban that would have taken power in a smooth way without causing great harm, whether immediately or in the future, from the point of view of human rights to people in Afghanistan. So, and if you think about the scenario that most commentators in the United States who were decrying the withdrawal, the one that they favored was something more like a so-called decent interval of 1 or 2 years in which the U.S.-backed Afghan national government would continue to fight, the U.S. would leave, and then it would fall to the Taliban just after 1 or 2 years of further fighting. Well, what does that actually mean? That means thousands of Afghan civilians and soldiers killed in that fighting, in that so-called decent interval. I guess it would look better for the United States to some people, particularly people in the United States who could feel like there was some kind of separation between U.S. actions and the results on the ground in Afghanistan. But that is not decent at all for the people of Afghanistan. And that scenario wouldn't have made things, in fact, better for the United States either. So, you know, I think the important thing is that the United States has finally, after 20 years, managed to make a strategic adjustment. And that's a profound thing. We have actually had a foreign policy that has been unwilling to pull back virtually anywhere over the course of my adult lifetime. But in a very big way, the President of the United States said, the choice really is to fight this war forever or to leave. And he chose to leave. And I think that is a certain kind of progress, even if the immediate consequences are, of course, grim ones. Now, Biden has said that the withdrawal from Afghanistan isn't just about Afghanistan. He said it marks the end of an era, a post-9/11 era in which the United States undertakes what he called major military operations to remake other countries. And I think that might be correct. It might very well be, barring another large terrorist attack, which seems pretty unlikely, that enough people in Washington have learned the lesson, and enough people well beyond Washington, that so-called nation-building or state-building wars are very unlikely to produce positive outcomes for U.S. security or even for people on the ground. That said, in another sense, what Biden is doing is only continuing a trend that began late in the George W. Bush administration, matured in the Obama-Biden administration, and continued through the Trump administration, which is to shift the U.S. war on terror to a low and no footprint mode of operations through aerial strikes and commando raids. And he's been pretty clear that he intends to continue that mode of waging the war on terror, though I think the administration is reevaluating the U.S. military footprint, including through its counterterror operations. So in a sense, the war on terror may have become only more endless because it's now being put on a more sustainable basis.
Right. So I want to see if we can dig into some of that policy inertia. Because on the one hand, you can kind of frame these debates about post 9/11 policies as argument one versus argument two. And it's just, you know, a balance of who's right and who's winning and so on. But it's also, there are institutional and bureaucratic structures and incentives that affect this. And I think what we've seen is extreme measures taken in a time of vulnerability and panic kind of don't go away. They're very sticky. So we're still burdened with the AUMF. We still have people locked up in Guantanamo Bay that haven't even been charged with a crime. Immigration policies and ICE have been affected. The Patriot Act and mass surveillance, none of this stuff has really gone away. The TSA, you know, it's become basically a permanent tax on Americans' time and money. And although it appears to have essentially zero utility in making air travel safer.
I do like the free baggies, though.
Yeah, those help. And even in Afghanistan, where, I mean, you can argue, yes, Biden resisted the policy inertia, but we're still planning on being pretty active there, as you intimated just then. What do you think is the mechanism here that perpetuates these policies beyond the surface level debate? What causes the inertia, the inability to adapt?
Well, I do think we have a remarkably cloistered foreign policy community in Washington. Of course, we come into 9/11 with a backdrop of Congress not having issued a formal declaration of war since World War II, since 1942. So there's a longstanding deference of Congress to the so-called imperial presidency. And of course, the construction of what President Eisenhower called the military-industrial complex, where we have a really fundamental problem of concentrated interests that have a strong stake in the United States being permanently mobilized for war or for deterrence all over the world, and diffuse what I think are diffuse interests of the American public in a more peaceful foreign policy that nevertheless are, because they're diffuse, very difficult to channel into the halls of Congress and into policymaking. So these are all long-range factors that are much more deeply rooted than 9/11. But 9/11 provided, if you like, the opportunity for the people in positions of power to lock in new bureaucracies, new wars, and new authorizations. The 2001 authorization for use of military force, as you mentioned, continues to be the only authorization from Congress for U.S. actions as part of this metastasizing war on terror, if you exclude the 2002 authorization that was specifically for the war in Iraq, and that too has been cited expansively. So essentially, you've got Congress weighing in once, passing this authorization with language so capacious it's practically begging to be abused by presidents, and doing this just a week after 9/11. There wasn't even real certainty about who the enemy was at that point. I think 9/11 and particularly the U.S. reaction to it has exposed for many Americans the depth of the inertia in our foreign policy making establishment. And I also think the failure of foreign policy, U.S. foreign policy, to adjust to the results that we were getting from the war on terror. And, you know, the war in Iraq, for example, became net unpopular pretty quickly, 2004, 2005. The Taliban insurgency also formed around the same time. The failure to adjust is, I think, a significant source of the so-called populist backlash against elites that's coincided with the financial crash and the aftermath of that. And so I think there is, though, the reason I have some kind of optimism, I don't know if it's optimism, a little bit of hope, is that somehow, in some way, over the course of this 20 years, changes have percolated up to the highest levels of our politics. We just had two presidential candidates who both, I think, would have ended the war in Afghanistan, despite all the support for it in the U.S. foreign policy community over two decades, who both were decrying the practice of endless or forever wars. So somehow the American public has come to conclusions about first the war in Iraq, then the war in Afghanistan, that I think were outstripped by the kind of debate there was in Washington. And it has exerted some influence. And that's why you see today somebody as close to the foreign policy establishment as Joe Biden. He got to the Senate in, 1973, do something that bucks the blob, so to speak, end this war in Afghanistan and declare that the very notion of using the U.S. military to engage in a liberal state building project is to be rejected.
Well, that kind of makes me want to ask about your theory of change. Do you think that the kind of substantive changes that you think we need to see to our post 9/11 foreign policies and kind of U.S. foreign policy in general will come from the bottom up like that? There's differences of opinion here. Some people think, you know, foreign policy is really an elite sport. To really make a substantive change that is lasting, you've got to build a counter elite that can service politicians who want to pursue a different route. Some people think it's going to be generational. You know, my colleague Trevor Thrall has done work on this. As soon as people that are of a similar age to you and I, and maybe a similar persuasion on these post 9/11 wars, get into Congress, you know, that will start to really mark the shift. And of course, as you know, right now, that it's a kind of special time. Not only are these higher level national debates happening, but there is a kind of insurgent force which has become prominent in DC of so-called restrainers. So the restraint coalition, so to speak, is a thing where it wasn't before. How do you actually, I'm not asking you necessarily to predict, but what's your theory of change for how we actually get to something different?
I think that when it comes to theories of change, there's no absolute answer. I certainly don't think that, you know, the key is the grassroots, because the grassroots are difficult to mobilize for understandable reasons about distant foreign policy problems. And then exactly how do you get from there to policymaking? Nor do I think, you know, the answer is entirely just more elites who think differently, because we have the problem of political incentives, which is an enduring one, due to the so-called military-industrial complex. And I think we've seen, actually, that much of the change, the course corrections over the last 15 years have, in fact, come from the American public. I don't think Barack Obama would have beaten Hillary Clinton in 2008, but for Obama's opposition to the Iraq War at the time when it was launched compared to Clinton's support for the Iraq War. I really don't. And I think Donald Trump is only sort of imaginable as a president for a number of reasons relating to the war on terror. But, you know, he was able to pass the commander-in-chief test with enough of the electorate to win, in part because he, you know, seemed like a truth teller when he blasted the Iraq war and other wars as a mistake. It seemed, I think, to many voters that, well, if he has that insight, even if he's lying about his initial stance on the Iraq war, if he has that insight, then some kind of change would be welcome from what we've been fed for a long time. So I think the answer somehow comes from an interaction of the, you know, if you will, top-down and bottom-up approaches. But I will be a little less boring than that. Right now, I think the main bottleneck is located in Washington. It is located in the elite, in think tanks, commentators, you know, people who can staff Congress, people who can staff administration. So, because if that part doesn't get right, then I don't think that the sentiment of the American public can be, in fact, channeled into policy, ultimately. And it also means it opens up the potential for a counter-elite, if you will, that can win some of these arguments. And regardless of where exactly the public is on some of these issues, I don't think ordinary Americans are very well informed about the low and no footprint parts of the war on terror, for example. It opens up the possibility of having meaningful policy victories on those issues as well.
One thing I find interesting is that with reference to this kind of elite debate that's going on in D.C., I asked Josh Shifrinson about this a few episodes ago, but you know, there was that article by Dan Dudney and John Eikenberry about the Quincy Coalition, as they call it, or the Restraint Coalition. And it's interesting that one of the, it's almost like they pointed out as a weakness that this coalition of people who all want a more restraint-oriented foreign policy have different domestic political opinions and agendas. And they described that or sort of framed it as a weakness or a potential problem. And then ironically, on the other side, folks like us tend to emphasize that as a good thing, as a strength of the movement. How do you see this? I mean, there are definitely different agendas going on, but there are some unifying aspects to the coalition as well. Talk a little bit about how you think that criticism lands from Dudney and Eikenberry, and what you think the overall kind of movement looks like right now.
Well, the Dudney and Eikenberry piece was rather odd. They, on the one hand, make a point of saying that there is a restraint coalition made up of people with otherwise divergent political viewpoints, except on foreign policy. And then they, at various times, attribute any position that might come from somebody in that coalition to the entire coalition to try to taint it. So it's a completely incoherent criticism, and I'm still trying to figure out how extremely intelligent people can arrive at the text as it stands in the pages of Survival. Nevertheless, I think clearly there is some confusion, I guess, over what it might mean to be in a restraint-oriented coalition. And personally, I think it's one of the least compromising kinds of political coalitions there could possibly be, because my experience has been that people from whatever end of the political spectrum very much understand that they are cooperating on a pragmatic basis with people with whom they otherwise disagree, but do align on the use of force and U.S. grand strategy, U.S. security commitments globally. And aligning on these issues and working together, as far as I can tell, requires no compromise with anybody's other beliefs. I personally have written about how I think U.S. military restraint should be coupled with, in some ways, more activism on issues like climate change. And others in that coalition disagree with me, and great, that's fine. but it really doesn't sort of affect the work of U.S. military restraint to connect this agenda to other issues. Now, if people disagree, that would be very interesting, but I haven't really seen somebody lay out the case. And in the absence of doing that, I kind of fail to see what the problem would be with operating in this kind of coalition. And in fact, I think all the controversy about it is quite revealing, because there's something else too that's going on. There's a primacy coalition. There's a primacy coalition of avowed imperialists, liberal internationalists, some human rights activists, people on the right, people on the far right, people in the center, you know, people in the left, on the left. There's a at least as robust and diverse a coalition in favor of U.S. global military primacy. But that gets naturalized because we're just so used to it. That's the status quo. But that coalition has, you know, people with all kinds of differences who are not, you know, made to denounce somebody else with whom they're in that coalition. And in fact, their coalition doesn't need to be very self-conscious because, again, it's the status quo. It's just how things are. So I hope that the conversation about the so-called restraint coalition will help us understand what the relationship is between people's broader politics and foreign policy. And if we view this in a fair way, I think we'll just have to admit that, you know, foreign policy views do scramble other ways in which people politically identify and affiliate. That's how it's always been. And if you don't like the agenda of U.S. military restraint, then sure, you shouldn't like the restraint coalition because you think it's pushing the wrong agenda. But that's about the only good objection to that coalition that I can come up with.
I want to ask you about a couple of the sort of broader ideas that you explore in your book, you know, and with reference to this elite debate that we've been talking about and what the other side seems to be saying. One thing they have going for them is that they come up with these very simplistic notions about how the world works and therefore how U.S. foreign policy ought to work. So the kind of story was, as you put it in your book, you know, isolationism on the part of the United States brought us World War I and World War II, and its opposite since then has prevented a third world war. And there's a kind of version of that with 9/11 as well, like the fight them over there so we're not fighting them over here type of idea, or some such version of that, where the claim is basically that all of the bumbling violence, securitization, and warfare that we've engaged in has somehow prevented another 9/11. These are pretty dubious claims on the merits, but they are compelling in their simplicity. And if you do need the American people behind you as an element in a battle like this, I suppose that's an asset. But it's also just a recipe for, you know, their version of those notions. It's just a recipe for constant militarism and a demand for perpetual policing of the order. So does restraint need better messaging? Or, I mean, talk about how this narrative developed and how we might inch our way towards a more constructive one.
Yeah, so in my book, I mainly give an account of how the United States made a decision to become the dominant military power and project its power across the globe, which I argue happened quite suddenly in about 18 months after the fall of France to Nazi Germany in the middle of 1940 and the attack on Pearl Harbor that brought the United States formally into World War II. And it was precisely because, and only because, a set of people in the United States came to think that the United States should embark on global dominance that they even thought to consider their political opponents at the time as isolationists. For most, what is still most of American history, this was not a term of much salience. It hardly anybody called their opponents, even opponents of joining the League of Nations after World War I, isolationists. So this is a term that has been overwhelmingly used as an epithet, even from the start, because I think we can agree that if anyone was an isolationist, it would be those who opposed U.S. entry into World War II and gathered in the America First Committee in 1940 and 41. And those people argued that the United States should prevent any attack on the Western Hemisphere, so it should have it should exercise political and military hegemony over an entire hemisphere. And then they had a range of views about how else the United States should engage globally, but most of them favored trade, as much trade as could be gotten in a world of diverse powers. Many were sympathetic to international law and institutions. So the label isolationism, we would never think to, based on what they actually stood for and believed, and also how they described themselves by and large, we would never have thought to label them that way had they not been branded as such by their political opponents. And the reason why this was so important for their political opponents to do and so effective is that it transformed what it meant to be internationalist in America. Against isolationism, you could favor U.S. military dominance while thinking that it could somehow also transcend power politics and war. Both of those contradictory ideas are somehow antonyms of isolationism. And that's why this narrative has really stuck, because it's so utterly useful, and you hear it so much today. So what does this mean for the cause of restraint? I'm not sure, in part because as an intellectual myself, I can't bring myself to unfairly label another group of people. I think that the main terms that restrainers use, you know, primacy versus restraint, are not flattering in their connotations to restraint. Primacy sounds good. Restraint sounds like you're keeping yourself from doing something you want to do. So maybe we're too pure for our own good. On the other hand, I also don't think that the emergence of isolationism as a category, as an epithet, was a kind of self-conscious act. It wasn't a conspiracy. It actually did reflect how people at the time saw things, how they feared that their opponents, it expressed what they believed their opponents would lead the world toward. They thought that the logical conclusion of their opponents' arguments would be to leave the United States in some sense isolated in the world. So to some degree, I think these things have to emerge organically and can't just be engineered. So I don't spend too much time trying to come up with better branding for restraint. I think people are increasingly understanding the argument, and that's what's most important.
I want you to tease out a little more this concept of internationalism. You make a good point in the book that it's a term that's kind of been abused. It's an idea, it has an intellectual tradition, and there's a difference between internationalism and the kind of internationalist armed supremacy that is often these days termed liberal internationalism. So how do you think about a version of internationalism that doesn't involve U.S. military hegemony and this sort of global cop role for the United States?
It shouldn't be difficult to think about. It shouldn't be controversial. The term internationalism came into use in the late 19th century in the United States and elsewhere. And initially, the people using it were largely pacifists. To be an internationalist meant to want to somehow either transcend nationalism or recognize that nationalism needed to be limited and find a balance with internationalism. The term connoted the transcendence of the system of power politics and the war that came with it. And one can go through a more complicated history of how the term evolved. But I think the outstanding change in the use of that concept came in World War II, when internationalism was yoked to the project of armed dominance by a single power, the United States. You might say that internationalism turned into its opposite. That is how it seemed, at least to some observers at the time. And since then, this particularly American post-World War II form of internationalism, yes, it connotes some efforts to cooperate with others, to lead a trading order, to make the world better in some way. But what seems to most fundamentally define internationalism in the American political debate is a commitment to the forward projection of U.S. military force. If the United States isn't number one militarily, then it can't be internationalist, and therefore it must be isolationist, which means that every other country, aside from the United States, is isolationist. And yet also the same people will say that all these countries are advancing on us and eating our lunch and so forth. So it's quite incoherent. And I don't know exactly, again, I'm not going to engineer some kind of quick fix to change our entire political discourse. But I think we could simply return to a mode of internationalism that shows how the United States can be engaged in the world through non-coercive means. And in fact, we can make the argument that America's propensity to coerce actually obstructs, at this point, meaningful interaction in the world. I think you can make a quite coherent argument when totalitarian powers were conquering territory and making a bid for hegemony in Europe and Asia, that the choice was U.S. power or their power. And therefore, U.S. military dominance at that time was, given the circumstances, the best way to secure U.S.-style liberal terms of international intercourse. That is, I think, a coherent position. But after the collapse of the Soviet Union, I think it becomes an incoherent position. After the collapse of the Soviet Union, what is really standing in the way of basically liberal modes of interaction and cooperation in the world? Well, the United States has sanctions on dozens of countries and entities, some sanctions that target entire populations and really make no sense for our national security or for anything else. Take Cuba or take Iran. And so I think we've got to understand, we've got to apply the critique that American internationalists from the 19th century and the early 20th century would have applied to us and say, if we want to engage in the world in a meaningful way, in a constructive way, and not obstruct people interacting, do we actually benefit from being so committed militarily and from using economic coercion as much as we do?
One of the things I worry about is when the debate changes a little bit. Right now, in particular, because of the anniversary of 9/11 and the withdrawal from Afghanistan, you know, basically the post 9/11 policies are restraint voices kind of have a leg up in that debate, just because it's been 20 years. Many people have seen the futility of the wars that we've engaged in, the expense of all this, etc. But eventually, something will come along that will kind of take the air out of this push. And there's a lot of threat inflation going on about China, but when we do face some kind of situation that seems to favor the primacists or the liberal internationalists, those who want to demonstrate a kind of aggressive militarist U.S. foreign policy, you know, they kind of have a leg up on in that discussion. And so how do you see the debate going forward when it's not such an easy slam dunk case as post 9/11 foreign policies have been a disaster?
I share your worry. And I think as long as there is wind at the backs of those who favor U.S. military restraint, we have to press the advantage as far as we can press it, because conditions may well change. And I think specifically what I worry about going forward is that it will seem to enough people that by getting out of Afghanistan, by, they may think, getting out of Iraq, though we still have thousands of troops on the ground there, also troops in Syria. Nevertheless, by making significant adjustments relative to the massive and lethal overcommitment of the United States after 9/11, we can, in fact, turn the page. Major changes have been made. There aren't really wars going on. Who really cares if we're sanctioning Iranians or Cubans, et cetera? And let's pivot now to China, or the combination of China and Russia, which are both a more serious threat, you might say, than states in the Middle East, are ideologically different, pose some legitimate challenges that we need to contend with, and don't raise the high risk of warfare, of large-scale warfare. Few people think that, you know, we're about to go to war with China or Russia. I don't think that. But I am worried about the commitments we've already made and where we'll end up in 10, 20 years. So as we move to a lower cost, less visible footprint in the Middle East, we do seem to be gearing up for an era of so-called great power competition, or perhaps a Cold War with China, or something that resembles the degree of enmity of the original Cold War, if it's not quite meeting whatever your definition of Cold War is. And that will seem like enough of an adjustment to people. And it does scramble some of the political battle lines that exist over, you know, getting the United States out of large Middle East interventions. So I worry about the United States applying the same indiscipline it's demonstrated in the greater Middle East in the last two decades to relations of greater consequence with China. I do worry that that will be a successful move for those who want to preserve America's outsized role in the world. And it will also be short-sighted by those who think that an intense security competition with China will allow the United States to really focus and, you know, get out of the Middle East and perhaps even draw down in Europe. Because over the long term, if China does indeed continue to rise, just look at the first Cold War the United States and the Soviet Union engaged in interventions across the global South. We need only to look at the Korean War and the Vietnam War from our own experience.
Stephen Wertheim, thanks for coming on the show.
My pleasure. Thank you.